And I know some scenarios, and I completely understand how to do it that way. I started doing it this way, and I was wondering if this, how, where this went wrong, or if this is wrong.
Well, it's not wrong, except, well, so you replaced your dy dx with that. My only question is, so what is that?
That's the x that gets
canceled. Oh, I see. So the x is canceled.
Cancel, and okay. Then I cross multiplied, so then we get okay. V squared times that, and Vx minus V times this. Oh, I would have to distribute.
Distribute.
No.
And something will cancel, I think.
Yeah, the
so you got a V squared over V, so you get V e to the V.
Yeah.
And here you're going to have V minus, let's see, why is, you might want to check your signs. Because I think one of those will cancel, like the V e to the V will cancel.
Yeah, the V e to the V does cancel right here. It's a negative because since it's in the denominator, it has to be minus. No, not, it's a,
right.
Yeah.
Except that, I mean, if I'm looking at this, it's, when you distribute, you get a minus e to the v, and you have to add.
I see.
So I don't know how you're getting this minus here.
I see.
So
yeah,
everything is correct except right. for maybe a minus sign error, and you end up with the right equation at the end, and then you want to solve that
gotcha.
For v, and then go back and undo the substitution. Don't be shy about getting in with a group or something, unless you just already know you're correct, and that's fine too. How many blank copies do you think I have? Fortunately, I have a blank copy, but you're welcome.
Wind up being like three equations equal C or something.
I'm going to be out of blank copies. If somebody comes in, we won't have enough. You can also write on the back if you just draw an arrow.
Like e squared times e squared is good 4.
Oh, okay.
So it's the same thing as e raised to 2 plus 2. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing as e squared times e squared.
Okay, so it'll be just e.
Your choice.
It doesn't really matter.
Well, remember what I did in lecture?
Yeah, you solved for x.
I solved for x because that was doable. Solving for y was going to be hard to do.
I did it. We also did it.
I mean, you can just leave it as an implicit equation as well.
I mean, it's possible, but it's very weird.
I mean, remember, there's a ln of ln y plus c.
Yeah, you solve for y.
How do you solve for y? You can't solve for y in this equation.
e to the power of something.
Well, you got y in two different places.
Yes, it's implicit.
It's either implicit or you're going to have to solve for x.
Okay, so it's implicit.
Yeah.
It's okay
to leave it as implicit. That's fine.
Okay, that's fine.
Because we do that a lot.
It looks so weird because it's e to the power of e.
So should we not leave it in this? Should we move that y over and make it an implicit?
But see, this is not an explicit.
Yeah.
You say you solve for y, but there's a y over here.
And that's what I'm asking. Is like, would it be better notationally to shift it over to the other side so it's not defining incorrectly?
If this is correct, then that's fine. That also defines it implicitly. But don't think that you're
not defining it explicitly.
This is not a function.
Because you've got y on both sides.
Are you multi- is this y times x?
No, this is y of the function of x.
Y is not a function of x. Here. Y is a function of x and y, which is nonsensical. Because you've got a y over here. You can't write this as a y of x equals something, which also has a y on the other side.
Question on that. Is that because, can you say that y is the dependent variable in that case?
Well, if you're treating y as a dependent variable, that's fine, but you can't call this a function because it is not.
It's not y of x.
It's not a function of x because you've got a y over here.
But it can be y equals that stuff.
You can have y equals.
But it's not a function.
You just can't say that it's a function.
Okay.
How you guys doing?
Because I'm not going to work it for you this time, because I did that already in class, and it should be in your notes, so you should already have it.
You say it doesn't matter whether we solve for x or y.
Your choice. So let's do five more minutes.
Now you just want to head out, and I'm actually shipping.
Yeah, I'm doing the same thing.
I don't like having that.
Yeah,
Separate.
Are these your lecture notes? Yeah,
these aren't lecture notes. I just wrote from the book.
But
these are just personal notes.
Okay. I was going to manipulate that to separate x and y.
But you can't do that.
I know.
The exponents are dividing.
Yeah.
If they were adding, then you could separate them.
So that's why you have to use the V.
Okay, let's hand in the quiz. Hand it forward.
Okay. Look behind you and get the quiz that's coming forward. Quiz.
Okay, so again, because I did this problem for you
the other day or last week, whenever that was,
I'm not going to do it again now. If you have questions about it, you can come to office hours and we can talk about it.
Best thing to do in a situation like this is if it's a problem that I've already done for you, you're welcome to open up your notes and just copy from the notes. Hopefully that will inspire you to take good notes, right? If I work a problem on the board, you write it down in your notes and then you have it there. You can take it home and study it, think about it. What I want to do now is, so we postponed a question from the homework a couple of times ago, 2.4 number 13, and I want to work that problem now for you. So if you recall the problem, it says, consider the initial value problem y prime equals y to the 1/3. So y prime equals y to the 1/3, and you're given the initial condition y of 0 is equal to 0. Now, I think this is a nonlinear differential equation, and so if we use the nonlinear theorem, we actually have to be a little careful, because y to the 1/3 is defined everywhere, so y to the 1/3 is continuous, but the partial of this, so partial of y to the 1/3 with respect to y, that's equal to 1/3 y to the negative 2/3, right, which is equal to 1 over 3 y to the 2/3, that does not exist if y is equal to 0. And now there's a remark, what the textbook calls a remark, after this nonlinear theorem, which says that if this function to the right is continuous, so y to the 1/3 is continuous, which it is, but if the partial with respect to y fails to be continuous, which it does fail to be continuous in this case, then what can we say? Well, we can say that the solution exists, but what? It's not unique. So what we're going to find is that this solution is not unique. And that's therein lies the difficulty. And you were the one that asked the question, so stop me if I'm saying something that doesn't make sense or doesn't seem to address the question that you had. But let me continue on a little bit. So let's go ahead and solve this, because we are going to be looking for situations where the solution exists. It's just not going to be unique. So we get dy dt is equal to y to the 1/3. We can separate variables, so we get dy over y to the 1/3 is equal to dt. And we can integrate both sides. And so this is, the right side is going to be t plus c. And the left side, this is the integral of y to the negative 1/3 dy, which is equal to y to the 2/3 over 2/3. And then the arbitrary constant from here will just get absorbed into that arbitrary constant. So we end up with an equation that looks something like, so this is the same as 3/2, or I can multiply both sides by 2/3, so we get y to the 2/3 is equal to 2/3 t plus c. C is arbitrary, so we can just leave it as c. And then I'm going to go ahead and cube both sides, so you get y squared is equal to 2/3 t plus c cubed. And so that's an implicit representation of the solution. And if we say, impose the initial condition, so if t is equal to 0, y is equal to 0, so we get 0 is equal to 2/3 times 0 plus c cubed. Well, this is 0, so you get, I can take the cube root of 0, which is 0, so c is equal to 0. So our solution then becomes y squared is equal to 2/3 t cubed. Now, this is, if you look at the problem, it says refer to example 3 in 2 pages or 4 pages prior to this. They go through this problem in some detail, at least part of it. They don't answer the question in the homework, but they do address this. One of the things that they're going to do is they're going to take the square root of both sides, and so you get y is equal to plus or minus 2/3 t to the, what? 3/2. Okay.
But then they do...
I'm sorry?
If it's already 3/2, why do you have to say plus minus?
This is saying the square root. So this could be the square root.
But then why do you put the plus minus if it's the square root?
Because
x squared equals 4, x equals plus or minus the square root of 4. Okay? So, now, the in the example, the textbook does something a little funny, which you may have missed when you were looking at this and thinking about this. And what they do is they say, you know, it's not unique because of what the discussion that we had before. So you can actually have different t-naught values. And when I looked at this originally, I think the reason I didn't want to answer your question was I didn't understand what they were doing with the t-naught and how that was different from the zero, but it's not. You still have the same initial value problem, but what we're going to do now is we're going to shift this thing to the right t-naught units, and then we can choose different values of t-naught. So y is equal to plus or minus 2/3 t minus t-naught to the 3/2. And basically this gives us some freedom in where we actually start this drawing this function. So if we plot, let's say this is y and this is t. So if you plot these, if you say the plus, it's going to look something like that. The minus is going to look something like that. But that's if we start with t naught equals 0. But we can also start here, and then we've got that situation. So for some non-zero t naught, we have those kinds of solutions. And so you actually have a whole bunch of these, in fact, an infinite number of them for different values of t naught. And the textbook does one more thing, and I'm going to end up erasing this so that we can actually solve the homework problem. But they define the function y of t is equal to a piecewise defined function, 0 for if t is, let's see how do I do this. So 0 less than or equal to t less than or equal to, or less than t naught, and it's equal to that expression that we derived there. So plus or minus 2/3 t minus t naught quantity to the 3/2 if t is greater than or equal to t naught. Now this may not make sense at the moment, but
I think that's flipped. I think it should be t is less than or equal to t naught.
No, greater than.
Okay.
So this is t naught. So if your t value is less than t naught, then we're just going to assign it the y value 0. In other words, like if you're here, and this is your t naught, what's the y value before? Well, it's going to be 0.
I see what you're saying.
So 0 all the way up to here, and then bam, it takes off. Does whatever it's going to do. Okay, so now,
Okay, any questions up to this point? Yes.
So why can you insert the T minus T naught? Is that just given in the problem?
Well, okay, so the question is, really, does this satisfy the differential equation? And it does. Because T naught is a constant. And does it satisfy the initial condition? Well, if... what we're basically saying is we're taking our initial condition to be T naught instead of zero. So if you plug in T equals T naught, then T naught minus T naught is zero, and this whole thing is zero, and of course it does satisfy the initial condition. So this function satisfies the initial condition, and it satisfies the differential equation. So it is a solution of the initial value problem. Okay. So, now, we're ready to do the homework problem. It says, part A, is there a solution that passes through 1, 1? And you thought that there should be, I think, and the answer in the back says no. Well, okay. So, if I take this, or you know, this, is there a solution that goes through 1, 1? Well, y is 1, and t is 1, so you get, now it's plus or minus 2/3 1 minus t naught raised to the 3/2 power. I'm going to square both sides, so we get 1 is equal to, the minus sign goes away, you get 2/3 1 minus T naught, and this whole thing has to be cubed. And I'm going to take the cube root of both sides, cube root of 1 is 1, so you get 1 is equal to 2/3 1 minus T naught. And now, multiply both sides by 3/2, you get 3/2 is equal to 1 minus T naught. So T naught is equal to 1 minus 3/2. Well, this is 2/2 minus 3/2 is -1/2. And so T naught is equal to -1/2. And and we're not allowed to have that because...
That's exactly the question I have, is why are we not allowed to have that?
Well, because of this condition right here.
But there's also the other condition.
This condition?
Yeah.
Well, you get zero if your t... So t has to be between zero and... It has to be greater than or equal to zero. Mm-hmm. And your t naught better be greater than zero. Or greater than or equal to zero.
If it wasn't, then the function would be discontinuous, wouldn't it?
Well, we're...
or at very least, it wouldn't fit y is zero equals zero.
No, that's not implied by the equation. It's... Let's see. If you have a negative value of t here, but that's... We're talking about t naught. Okay.
If T naught is negative, then Y is zero, then equals zero.
If you have T naught is negative, then first of all, we have to agree that this is the basic solution. Okay, and we're shifting this to the right T naught units, and so T naught is going to have to be a positive number. We're not allowed to do this.
See, that's the part I fail to understand. Because,
why is that? Because the function diverges at that point and isn't still zero. So we need y of zero to equal zero. Otherwise, if we do this, then y at zero is going to be plus or minus 2/3.
Well, yeah. If t is equal to t naught, then this would be zero, and you would get y equals zero. So it would satisfy the initial condition.
But what I'm talking about y of zero.
Do you?
So if t is 0 and t naught is negative 1/2, then it's, you're going to be at y of 0 and it's not going to equal 0 in the output function.
But we're changing that value.
Yeah, this is really becoming t naught here.
Oh, no, that's not it. That's not what I'm saying.
Well, okay. Yeah. If that's the only thing that you had, you were puzzling about, then, so you did all the rest of this?
Yeah. My question specifically, though, is the second condition. It says t is greater than or equal to t naught, and in the problem it says y of 1 is equal to 1, so if t is equal to 1, t naught would be equal to negative 1/2, and t is still greater than t naught, and it does satisfy that condition.
But it doesn't satisfy the first one.
It doesn't satisfy the initial condition.
Which is this y0 is equal to 0.
Yeah, so if you plug negative 1/2.
Okay, let's try that.
And
so
0 into t, you get something other than 0.
Yeah, but that's not the condition you're given. You're saying y of 1 is equal to
okay,
1.
Okay, let's let t naught equal negative 1/2. Let's see what happens.
Yeah.
Okay. So you get y is equal to plus or minus 2/3. And now, what do you want t to be?
1.
1. Okay, so 1 plus 1/2. And then that's the whole thing's going to be raised to the 3/2 power. Okay, so, and then... so this is 3/2, and so you get y is equal to plus or minus, so 2/3 times 3/2 is 1 raised to the 3/2, which is 1.
Yeah. And that was the question. It says, is there a solution that passes through the point 1/1?
And I think the reason why it says that that's not the solution.
You're not allowed to. Yeah, you're not allowed to use t naught less than 0.
Yeah.
And why?
And I think that the reason why they're saying that is that the solution is because the solution is constrained by it passing through that point and then also fitting that that initial value problem.
But the second you shift it, the initial value changes.
The initial value doesn't change if you shift it to the right, because then you're just saying the initial value is 0 if 0 is less than or equal to t is less than t naught.
Okay, let me. I'm gonna have to think about this one.
Yeah.
I agree.
if you.
No, you know, it's
because when you say it passes through point 1/1, you're saying additional point.
Well, that's the reason they won't let you do it. That they're saying no because you can't have t naught equal to negative 1/2. And I agree. I have to think more clearly about why this is, you can't go to why can't you say you know greater than negative infinity, right?
And I get the condition is on the top, 0 is less than both t and t naught, but the bottom one doesn't specify that either t or t naught is greater than 0.
No. This is a piecewise defined function.
Mm-hmm.
So this says t is greater than or equal to t naught.
But it doesn't say that either one of those is necessarily greater than 0.
This one did.
But then the whole function changes.
No, it doesn't. This is a piecewise defined function.
Then
these make up the domain of your function.
Maybe I'm not understanding the piecewise part.
Well, then go look at your pre-calculus textbook or come talk to me during office hours.
Am I wrong in thinking that if the top condition, then the function is equal to 0? If the bottom condition, then it's
equal to 0? Yeah, but together, the union of these makes up the domain of your function.
That's a piecewise
function. It's piecewise defined. It's one function. It's not two functions. It's one function.
Yeah, because the function would be undefined if t naught was less than 0.
Well, if this is the condition, then it would be undefined if t naught is less than 0. And that is correct. The question is, this seems arbitrary. That's what you're saying, is it's arbitrary. But there's an additional question. It's like, you're not quite sure what a piecewise defined function is, and you need to think about that a little bit. But
And there's no shame in that. I mean, believe me, I'm rethinking some of these things too as we do these problems. But you know, you can't say that this isn't imposing a condition, so I can use this. This is imposing a condition, and if you're less than zero, then you're not in the domain of the function. This is a single function. It's zero, and then it does whatever it does, right?
So what you're saying is that a piecewise defined value, if they put zero anywhere in it, then that condition applies to all other conditions too?
This is the piecewise defined function. So t cannot be less than zero, and t naught cannot be less than zero.
Condition.
Then I'm not understanding the second condition.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Can we talk about this
after? Yeah, let's talk about this.
Okay.
So I want to do part B, because there you can calculate it. And so the question was, can you have it pass through the point 2, 1? So you get 2, one is equal to, now we're going to avoid the zero, so we get plus or minus 2/3 times t. Now, in this case, t is 1, or I'm sorry, 2. So 2 minus t naught, we don't know what t naught is, and then raised to the 3/2 power. Now, if we take the 1 to the 2/3 power, we still get 1, but we have to get rid of the minus sign here. So you get 1 is equal to 2/3 times 2 minus t naught. Multiply both sides by 3/2, you get 3/2 equal to 2 minus t naught. Therefore, t naught is equal to 4 minus 3/2, which is 1/2. And that is allowed. And in fact, you end up with the function plus or minus 2/3 t minus 1/2 all raised to the 3/2 power. And this is the answer that's in the back of the book for this, right? And then the third part C is for the, let's see, what are the possible y values for y of 2? Well, you're limited to t naught either being 0 all the way up to t naught equal 2. And therefore, if you plug in, so here, using the same equation, if I replace this with a 0, so you get 2 times 2 is 4, 4/3 raised to the 3/2, and it's going to be plus. So 4/3 to the 3/2, that's the maximum value that y of 2 can be. And then if you plug in 2 here, you're going to get a 0. So 2 minus 2 is 0, so you get 0. Now, because of the plus or minus, they treat this as an absolute value. So, and this is exactly the answer that's in the back of the book. So, again, we're assuming that the smallest value of t naught is 0 in executing that. So, but I will give some thought as to why this has to be 0 and not something less than 0.
I think it's specifically the conditional part that I'm misunderstanding. Because to me it was one condition applies to things greater than 0. The other one doesn't say anything about where the...
Yeah, but that's exactly what we mean by a piecewise defined function.
And that's why I want to discuss this after.
Okay.
Because
right.
There's something there I'm not understanding.
Okay.
This is section 2.4.
This is 2.4, number 13. And by the way, it's a very good question, and I'm glad you asked the question, and you know, I think it warrants a little bit more thinking on my part, but that's what they're intending for you to do on this. Any questions about this? I hope you're all paying attention to this. Anytime I spend this much time on a problem, it could appear, you know, somewhere.
Certainly a final, yes.
Is it kind of arbitrary why they made it minus T now rather than plus T?
Well, because it's a shift to the right. I mean, think about function transformations from college algebra or, you know, pre-calculus. If T naught is a positive number, and you're like x minus 2 squared, what is that?
That's x squared.
It's x squared, but it shifted 2 units to the right. So the minus 2 is a horizontal shift right 2 units, yes.
If T naught was less than 0, wouldn't it then be undefined around the initial condition?
We're playing games with the initial condition.
Right.
So,
like, slightly to the left of T naught, if T naught's negative, then it would be the square root of the negative number.
Why?
Because it would be...
Because
it would be less than...
No, because if you had a number that's less than... Let's say this is negative one-half, so... T minus a negative one-half is T plus one-half, but now you can have a T that's as negative as negative one-half. So negative one-half plus one-half is zero, and you can take the square root of zero.
Right, but it doesn't have to be continuous around the initial condition.
Well, that's why it would be...
That's not why you can't shift it.
Okay, so they probably ought to have that, so you don't want it to be equal.
Right,
but it could be.
That's the reason why you can't shift it left, like it's.
No, because if this were a negative number, T naught is negative, then it just means you could have negative values of T. I think that's the problem. I think that they want you to have a function that has positive values of T. But I'll have to think about it some more. Okay, this is all good discussion. I just don't want to spend the rest of the class time talking about this problem. I wanted to fulfill my commitment to talk about it at some point, and I think I've done that. If there continue to be questions about it, let's take it offline. Okay. Okay. So, what we're going to do today is section 3.2. Which is systems of differential equations, and a good part of the rest of the course is going to be devoted to this topic. Not all of it, but a good part of it. So, and in fact, the way the book sort of behaves, I say that, it's kind of a weird way to talk about a textbook, but the you know, for example, one of the things that we're going to do is we're going to take second-order differential equations and we're going to convert them into a pair of first-order differential equations, at least some of the time. That way we can get phase portraits for a second-order differential equation, which is something that you couldn't do otherwise. And phase portraits are very important because it shows you, like, are you circling around an equilibrium? Are you spiraling into the equilibrium? Are you spiraling out from the equilibrium? So phase portraits are going to become it's kind of like the phase line diagram that we had before, but in two dimensions. Yes?
They also look pretty cool.
Yeah, they can be very pretty. In fact, when you do it in three dimensions, when you have, you know, more complicated equations, you can see the cyclical behavior. So, yeah, we're only going to do two-dimensional phase portraits in this course. But I want to do a couple of examples of practical problems that are going to give you systems of differential equations. And one of them is predator-prey. Now, we're going to devote a whole section to predator-prey a little bit later in the course, but just to show you the kind of problem that you could see, suppose that you've got a predator, and I mean, think wildlife, right? So an owl out in the woods, and the prey is a mouse or something. Or, you know, owls will just eat about just anything. But, or, you know, hunters and deer. Now, hunters have other choices besides deer, but, you know, you get the idea. The simplest predator-prey problem is one in which the predator eats only one thing, and the prey is the only thing that's, you know, it's eating grass or something. So, it's not being eaten by anything other than the particular predator that we're talking about. And of course, that doesn't describe anything in the real world, right? Every prey probably is preyed upon by multiple things, and every predator probably gobbles up pretty much anything, you know. But, so these are simplifications of the real world. And so we start with the idea that if you have a prey that's unconstrained, and in a sense, that's what happens to the deer population when you don't hunt them, and they have no natural predators in the wild anymore. You know, it used to be lions and tigers and things would take down a deer, but now it's just people with shotguns or whatever, bows and arrows maybe. But you know, but left to themselves, if there's enough foliage, the deer population will just grow exponentially. And so, let's say we have X1 is the number of deer, not D-E-E-R. Okay, D-E-A-R is something else. And let's say X2 is a predator, which would be tigers or something. So the number of tigers. And if it helps you, you can come up with different symbols for these. But now, how are the deer going to behave? Well, so X1 prime is going to equal some constant, let's say A times X1. So exponential growth of the deer. And sure enough, left to themselves, until they run out of foliage, you know, or space, their territory, they're somewhat territorial, you know, but until then, the population grows exponentially. And we're going to model this as a continuous exponential. They obviously, you know, they probably have offspring once or twice a year or whatever, and so it's like annual compounding rather than continuous compounding. But and left to themselves, the tigers, if they don't have any food, what are they going to do? They're going to exponentially decay, right? They're going to starve to death. So X2 prime is going to equal negative, and let's say B, and let me do A1 here and B1 here, and times X2. So this is exponential growth, and this is exponential decay. So left to themselves, the deer population will just grow forever, and the tiger population will eventually decay to zero. But that's not how the world works, right? So when you put deer and tigers together, what happens? Well, the tiger will maul the deer, and there'll be less deer, and there'll be more tigers, right? So, how do you model that? That's really the question. And there are different ways of doing it, but one easy way to think about it is, so these things want to grow, the deer, but when you introduce tigers, they actually, it's like a rate of increase minus the rate of decrease. So let's use A2 to be that coefficient, and then it's the product of X1 and X2. So X1 times X2. So if X1, let's say if X2 is zero, if there are no tigers, then this term is zero, and the only thing you have is exponential growth. If both of these are non-zero, then it means that they're interacting to the detriment of the deer. And So that is going to cause a decay. Now there's a, you know, there's a positive term here, but there's a negative term here. A1 and A2 are both assumed to be positive constants. And so the net result of these will be some growth and possibly some loss. Now, how would you get the equilibrium? Factor. Well, factor, but why? I mean, what is this right side equal to?
Zero.
So the right side is zero. X1 prime is zero. It means that the rate of change of the deer population is zero, and then you could solve for X1, assuming that you knew what X2 was. Now, okay, so you have a similar interaction term for the tigers, because otherwise the tigers are just going to continue to decay to zero, their population, but what we actually see happening is you get a plus here, and let's use B2 as your coefficient there. B2 times what? X1, X2. So, if either of these is zero, then you won't have any gobbling up of the deer and no growth of the tiger population. But, so these are what we call coupled equations. When you put two equations together and you have some terms in both of them that involve the other, we call that coupling of differential equations. And it's the coupling term that gives rise to the interesting behavior. Now these coefficients can be small, but you don't want them to be zero because then you don't have any coupling. And you wouldn't, then, you know, the deer population would go out of control and the tiger population would go to zero. So, now we can, now another thing to notice about this system is that it's nonlinear. All of the, most of the equations that we're going to be doing this semester are going to be linear, even the systems. So this may not be the best model for predator-prey because of the nonlinearity. It makes it harder to solve. But we'll see that there is a way to solve a nonlinear system. Actually, what will be involved is a linearization of the equation near an equilibrium point, and we'll talk about that later. Okay, any questions about this? Now, I'm not going to try to write this in matrix form because it's, since it's nonlinear, it doesn't really it's not amenable to something linear like matrices. Okay, so now another example. And we're going to be seeing a lot of these kinds of examples, but I just wanted to, I'm certainly not going to try to solve this now. Another example would be, suppose you have interacting tanks of liquid. And now, left to themselves, they're just going to do whatever they did, like the problem that was on the first exam. But let's assume that you've got some input and to the first tank, and let's say that each tank has a certain quantity of sludge or pollutant or chemical or whatever, so Q1, Q2, Q3, and let's say that the volumes of these, and I'm going to give you specific numbers so we can actually write the equations, so 500 gallons... for the first one, 400 gallons for the second, and 200 gallons for the third. So 400 gallons and 200 gallons. And we're going to arrange this one so that the volumes stay the same. So we've got 20 gallons per hour going in to the first one. So 20 gallons per hour going in. And let's assume 4 pounds per gallon of whatever the crud is. So 4 pounds per gallon going in. And let's assume that we've got 30 gallons per hour coming out going into Q2. So it's 30 gallons per hour Now I'm going to have another input here in a moment.
You have 20 gallons per hour, or four, under that you have
4 pounds per gallon.
Oh, 4 pounds.
And of course, the concentration of whatever's going in here is going to depend on the concentration that's in this tank, which we can figure out. And then let's suppose 30. So going this way, we've also got 30 gallons per hour going that way. And now coming out of the third tank here, let's assume that it's 20 gallons per hour. And we're also going to have another output from the third tank going to the first tank. So let's say something that looks like this. And it's going to come out of here and it's going to go in there. And let's call that 10 gallons per hour. So 10 gallons per hour. So let's first of all convince ourselves that the rates are the same into each of the tanks. So 20 gallons going in here, but 10 gallons per hour going in here. So you get a total of 30 gallons per hour going in and 30 gallons per hour coming out. So the volume of the first tank is constant. Then you got 30 gallons per hour going in here, and you got 30 gallons per hour coming out here, and there are no other inputs or outputs. So the volume here is constant. They don't have to remain constant, by the way. You know, it just makes your life easier if they are constant. And then you got 30 gallons per hour going in here. You got 20 gallons per hour coming out, but you got another 10 gallons per hour coming out over here. So 30 gallons going out, 30 gallons going in. So the volume of the third tank is constant. Okay. So far, so good? Now, if you don't like the tank problem, this is going to be your worst nightmare. So try to figure this thing out. So you're going to have a DQ1 dt. You're going to have a DQ2 dt. And you're going to have a DQ3 dt. And each one of them is basically rate in minus rate out. And rate has to be in pounds per hour, because the units here, Q is in pounds, right? It's a quantity, it's not a concentration. So these are pounds, pounds, pounds. By the way, they wouldn't have to all be the same units. You might have to do unit corrections on them to make this work, but in the simplest case, this is what you do. So your Qs are in pounds, your time is in hours, so all of your rates have to be in pounds per hour. So if I take 20, for example, 20 gallons per hour and multiply that by 4 pounds per gallon, what happens? Well, the gallons cancel and you get 4 pounds per, I'm sorry, 4 times 20 is 80 pounds per hour. And so that's the input. So I'm going to put 80 here. And then I have to have two terms that are subtracted. I'm sorry, one more term that's added, and then the term that's subtracted. So what is the... Let's do the input here. So what is that going to be? So 200... I'm sorry, 10 gallons per hour times what?
Times the concentration of Q3.
Which is what?
Q3 over 200.
So this is going to be 10 over 200, which is 1 over 20, which is 0.05. So 0.05 O5Q3. And, of course, the units are implied here, pounds per hour, okay? And then minus the 30 gallons per hour, so 30 gallons per hour times what?
Q1
over 500. So Q1 over 500, and now you get 3 over 50, whatever that is. So 3 over 50 times Q1, and that's your first equation. And notice there's a Q1 term and there's a Q3 term. And so you've got a coupling between the first equation and the third equation. If you didn't have any coupling between these equations, then you could just solve them separately. You wouldn't have to have a system. Does that make sense? Okay, any questions on this? Because if you understand this, then we can just write down the others. I'll go ahead and do them, because you guys might need some practice with this, but I'm going to erase this. Yeah. You didn't copy it down?
No.
You got to copy this stuff down. Let's see, what is it? It's,
it was 20
gallons per hour times 4 pounds per gallon.
Oh,
no. Yeah. This is one of the hardest things for students to learn is how to take notes. I don't even think I'm all that fast at writing on the board, but you know, one thing I learned as an undergrad, and I had, you know, I was an undergrad in physics, and the professor would just come in and fill up a board, and we just got in the habit, we just wrote every, you know, just like blindly write down everything that they wrote on the board, and then you go home and you're like, what did this mean, you know? And so you just got to get good at that. And I hope some of you are seeing the danger of not copying things down into your notes. Any questions at this point? Can I erase this now? Okay. I just need the space. So maybe I should write it someplace else, right? So now Q2, so the input is going to be 30 times what? Q1 over 500, so 30, so 3 over 50 times Q1.
How do you get 30 over 50?
30 over 500, it's 3 over 50. Minus, so that's the input because it's going in, and then what's coming out is 30 times Q2 over 400, which is 3 over 40. So 3 over 40 Q2. And, you know, if you're thinking about how are you going to do this on a test, you got to get a little fast about, you know, figuring these things out quickly. Because the next step is going to be to put it into a matrix and do all the matrix stuff. And then the third, the inputs, there's one input, so it's 30 so it's exactly this term here.
3 over 40.
So 3 over 40 Q2. Minus, and then you've got your 10 times Q3 over 200. So 10 over 200 is 1 over 20. It's minus.
Or minus.
So 1 over 20 Q3 minus, and then 20 over 200 which is 1 over 10, right? So 1 over 10 Q3.
Is it all right if I just...
You can combine these. Yeah.
Oh, so that's that, and then there's another one.
Yeah, because there's the output here, and then there's the output there, and you can combine those. And in fact, it would be 30 times the same concentration as here. Okay? How we doing? Now, I'm not going to spend time and solve this now, but... because I want to develop some matrix stuff that we're going to need. But anyway, these are in this case, the three coupled differential equations. And they're all linear first order. So we wouldn't have to do anything else. We could put them into a matrix. The one thing that makes it a little complicated is that you've got the 80 here, which is the constant. And so this ends up being a non-homogeneous system of differential equations. If this 80 were not here, of course you wouldn't have any input, but if it weren't here, then you would have a homogeneous system, which would be a little easier to solve. Okay? So I'm going to erase all this. Any questions?
So eventually the system would overflow.
No, it would not overflow.
There's
20 gallons coming in, or there's 20 gallons coming out. 20 gallons going in, 20 gallons coming out. And all the volumes of the, as I showed before, all the tank volumes are constant. Okay? Any other questions? I mean, I don't mind taking a little extra time at this stage to make sure that we all understand this stuff. Because, you know, when I saw this 40 some years ago, it's like, oh my God. Yes?
Intuitive question here. If the inflow is some constant rate in, I assume there is going to be an equilibrium point where all the tanks have the same concentration?
Yep. I mean, yeah, you're exactly right. Now, I think, are they going to be the same concentration? Probably yes. If I had to, I mean, I think I want to say that, yeah. Because you basically have a closed loop here. You've got an input and you've got an output. Same argument that we made with the tank problem on the exam. You know, intuitively, you're putting in a concentration and the volume is staying the same. So eventually, the entire contents of the whatever the system is. I mean, you can think of this as a single tank with just some currents or something flowing, and eventually it all gets mixed in together.
Would there be a possible way to have a system similar to this one, just one input and one output? Would you have concentrations forming in one tank or another, or would that end up...
Well, if the volume is not constant,
okay,
then that would happen. Because
yeah,
it could, you know, if the volume is going down, then you could think of the concentration increasing. So, yeah. I mean, that's a good question, but yeah, I think that's true. Any other questions? Okay. So, I'm going to erase this. Now, you guys all remember your matrix stuff, right? No. Well, you can do it on the calculator. It won't help you for some of it, but... okay. Actually, so one more example I want to do... converting a second order equation. I mentioned that before, so let's just go ahead and do that. So y double prime plus 2y prime plus 4y equals sine t. Now this is non-homogeneous because you have terms that don't include y. And so those, any term that's, that doesn't include y, usually you write those on the right-hand side. All the y terms you would write on the left-hand side. And at least when you're writing it in this form. So, and this is a pretty typical second-order linear differential equation. Linear in your dependent variable. So, how do you convert it? Well, we're going to define x1 is equal to y, and x2 is equal to y prime. Now we have to play a little game here. So so if we take the derivative of x1, so call it x1 prime, well, that's going to be y prime. And so anywhere you see a y prime, we're going to end up replacing it with x1 prime. And so then also, well, and we can write, actually the other way to do this would be to write this as x2. Okay. Now, if we take the derivative of this, because you see, right, y prime is x2. So this actually becomes our first equation. X1 prime equals something on the right-hand side. And then x2, differentiate it, so you get x2 prime is equal to y double prime. But what is y double prime? Well, it's equal to, you solve this equation for y double prime, so you get negative 2y prime minus 4y plus sine t. Now we've got to get rid of the y's here. We're trying to substitute out all the y's and turn them into x1's and x2's. So, therefore, x2 prime is equal to, well, negative 2, what is y prime? Well, it's x2. Minus, and then 4y, what is y? X1, so 4x1, and then plus sine t. Now, we usually write this in a more agreeable form. So let's do the x1 prime. So x1 prime is equal to, now I want to have space for x1 and x2 and then a right hand side, or the non-homogeneous term. So I'm going to say 0x1 plus 1x2 x2 prime is equal to what? Well, I'm going to start with the x1. So negative 4 x1 minus 2x2 plus sine t. So that's our system of differential equations. We've taken a second order and turned it into two first order equations. And that has a lot of advantages and some disadvantages. I mean, if one of the things that we're going to learn to do is we're going to use Laplace transforms to solve this, and we don't need to convert it to a system. We can just solve it directly with Laplace transforms, and we'll spend a whole chapter on that later on in the course. But the problem with that is that you don't see the phase portrait. So if you want a phase portrait, then you would go through this exercise and solve it this way. Now, an advantage of doing this, besides the phase portrait, is that your numerical techniques will work on first-order equations. You have more powerful numerical techniques like Euler or Runge-Kutta to do first-order, and you can do systems of first-orders. You would not do that on a second-order. You would convert it to first-order. So, like in grad school, all of the systems of differential equations that I worked on were all systems of first order. They weren't necessarily linear, And that's why you can use numerical techniques on them and solve them. But so there are trade-offs between the second order representation and the system of first order. I will say this. All of the equations of physics, almost all of them, are represented as second order, either ordinary differential equations or partial differential equations. So, you know, it's this mathematicians like this, physicists like this, and also engineers tend to like this more. So you're getting both sides of it, hopefully. The textbook will often, you know, if you're solving something like this, it'll say, first, convert to a system, and that may seem a little strange when there are some really simple techniques for solving it when it's in the second order form. Okay. Now, the next step I want to do is I want to represent this in a matrix. Yes?
X1 and X2 are just two variables. Like
dependent variables.
It could be like T and G.
So T is your independent variable here. X1 and X2 are your dependent variables, and they're functions of T. Yes?
How do you get the first equation, X1 prime equals X2?
Well, I defined X1 equal Y.
Yep.
And then differentiate both sides. And by the way, I guess at the same time we said X2 is equal to Y prime. But when you differentiate this equation, you get X1 prime is equal to Y prime. But what is Y prime?
X2.
So X1 prime is equal to X2. So X1 prime is equal to X2 plus 0 X1. There's a placeholder here for the X1. Because I want to put it into a matrix. Did you have a question?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, you don't have to write the 0x1 when it's in this form. It just makes it clearer when you're trying to go to a matrix representation. So let's do that. So your left-hand side is going to be x1, x2, and then I'm going to put a prime symbol. So think of this as a column vector or column matrix. And so if you differentiate a vector, it's the derivative of each of the components of the vector. Now, those of you who've had calculus 3 know that instinctively, probably. If you haven't had calc 3, you might not know that. But it's, and you have, most of you, probably none of you have had matrix calculus apart from the Calc 3 stuff. So, and we don't use matrices in Calc 3 to represent vectors anyway. So, how many in here have taken linear algebra? I know you're taking it now. So, a couple of people. Okay, so 3.
I've used it.
4. So, 3 or 4 or 5. Huh?
I've used it for DC circuits, the DC circuit analysis.
Yeah. Yeah, a formal course in linear algebra is probably going to be more rigorous than what you see in DC circuits. But yeah, that's good. You've seen some matrices. You all have probably seen them in earlier courses in math. We do it here at ACC. We do it in college algebra. But then we don't do it again until now. So don't feel bad if you don't remember your matrix stuff. You'll have plenty of time to learn it. And then now we do what is called a coefficient matrix. So we just pull the coefficients out. So 0, 1, negative 4, negative 2. So we call this the coefficient matrix. And then we multiply that by another column vector or column matrix, which is your x1, x2. And then plus, we got basically plus a 0 up here, right? So you got a 0 here, and then you've got a sine t here. So that's a matrix representation of your problem. And now I'm going to introduce a notation here that I hope you'll follow or at least sort of respect. if you don't follow it completely, at least you'll understand it. I'm going to call this matrix X. Now, you've got to be careful. If I write X like that, I'm not really distinguishing it from a variable in the real number system. So to indicate that it's a vector, I'm going to do that. And so you'll see that in a differential equations course, we often do that sort of thing. They can, in the textbook, I'm not even sure how they do it. They probably bold it or sometimes. See, this looks almost like a Roman numeral. You'll get used to it. So this is actually X prime. And we're going to call this matrix A, uppercase A. Uppercase letters are often reserved for matrices, especially if you're in a matrix context. But then you're multiplying A times what?
X.
So X prime is equal to A times X plus, and then we're going to call this big G of little t. And that big G of little t is, we're indicating that, it's, first of all, it's a matrix. And secondly, it's a function of t. So it's a t is your independent variable. Notice A is not a function of t. Now, X is also a function of t, but we normally would not write the of t for the X, because we already know that that's going to be a function of t. And so this is the equation that we really want to solve. And this is, we're going to spend a lot of time with this kind of formalism. Now, you may not remember, so I wrote this down, but do you believe it? If you remember from college algebra how to do this, you do row times column. So I would think of this as a row and a row times a column. So how do you do matrix multiplication? And this is something you might want to review. So this point, this right here, is going to be, I'm sorry, this right here is this times this plus this. Really what I'm trying to do, I guess, is show that this matrix equation takes the information from here and correctly represents it. So 0 times x1 plus 1 times x2 is 0 times x1 plus 1 times x2, and then plus 0. And then second row times this column, so negative 4 times x1 plus negative 2 times x2, so negative 4x1 plus negative 2 times x2 plus sine t, and that gives us our second row. Now, this, I'm doing it for this particular problem, but you're going to see this for all of these systems. You're going to have a coefficient matrix times your x plus possibly some, what we would call a non-homogeneous term here, and then that's equal to your x prime. And so for a lot of what we're going to do initially, we're going to ignore the g of t. We're going to say that that's equal to 0. Although in this case it's not, but okay. Questions about this? If this matrix stuff looks completely foreign to you, come talk to me, or you know, maybe spend some quality time this weekend looking at matrices just a little bit. By the way, you can get totally lost in matrix stuff. Mostly what we're going to need, we don't need a whole lot of matrix arithmetic or matrix algebra, but we are going to do eigenvalues and eigenvectors. So we need to worry about that. We'll talk about that. Okay, so I'm going to erase this. Okay. If I had something just simple, like x prime equals 2x minus 3y, and y prime is equal to 4x plus 2y, can we convert that to a matrix equation? So this is the kind of basic skill. We did a harder example over here. Let's just maybe convince ourselves that we know how to do the easy thing here. So I'm still going to write this is XY, and then I'm going to put a prime there. You can't forget this prime, and you don't want to put the prime inside, because then you can't call it X. So this matrix is X, big X, and with a prime after it. And this is equal to, so what's the coefficient matrix? So 2, negative 3, 4, 2. And then we multiply by what? X and Y. And again, convince yourself that this is true. So 2 times X plus negative 3 times Y is equal to the X prime. That's the first row. And then the second row, Y prime is equal to 4 times X plus 2 times Y. And so that's, another way to write this would be X prime is equal to A times X. And so that's your matrix equation. Both of these we call the matrix equation. This is the matrix equation. This is the matrix equation. This one is just more elaborated. You know, we go into more detail here. But a lot of times we can do matrix algebra on this and maybe solve for X. So we'll see that later on. But so oftentimes we start with something like this, we write it like this, and then we condense it down to an equation of this form. And this is kind of what we carry around in our back pocket. This is the differential equation for a system represented as a matrix equation. Okay. Now, let's... let me erase this over here. Okay, equilibria.
Question for you.
Yes.
Are the letters you were using to describe the matrices arbitrary?
These are common. You might have a Y.
Would it be wrong?
We're going to have a V. Would it be wrong to do what?
To pick any arbitrary letter for that?
A Q?
Q, S.
I mean, there's certain things that make sense, and like this one I probably wouldn't do. Looks weird. I know it's tempting to do your own thing sometimes, but if you're in industry, one of the things you always want to do, you become a team player. You follow the conventions that your team has, whatever those might be. And like, I was a programmer for 20 years, and so you go in and you're like, okay, I don't like the way they label stuff, but I'm not going to change it. So you adopt the conventions that your team has and go along, get along, you know, in that sense. But now, if it's something that you don't know, if it's a word problem and you're introducing symbols, probably start with the letters that you're most familiar with. If you need to branch out from there, pick something that makes sense. Always remember that you're talking to an audience. When you write something on a piece of paper, even if it's just an audience of one, 6 months from now, you're going to come back and you're going to look at that paper and you're going to say, what the hell did I write? And... really, I mean, it's really true. You won't, if you won't know what your R meant, you know, when in fact should have been an X or something. But to answer your question, you have a lot of freedom in choosing the notation. I just would be careful that the notation try to be as close to standard as possible. It makes it easier for you as well. when you're solving these problems.
So standard would be to pick one of the variables that you're using and then use that in the notation.
Yeah, so for example, I mean, we have certain letters that we use for indices or integers. Like, if you're trying to represent an integer, you probably wouldn't do it with an R. You'd probably do it with an N or an M. You know, those kinds of things. So there are conventions that you're going to see, and that I think this textbook follows those conventions pretty closely without saying so, although it does do things like psi, you know, a lot of Greek letters and stuff like that, which we will also use in the right context. I mean, if there's any doubt, try it and see how I react. And I'll try to be, you know, tolerant. Yes.
So how is this form different from the AX equals B matrix form?
Well, this is, if so you're familiar with something like this. Okay. If you had a linear algebra class, then this is going to be a vector, this is a vector, and this is a matrix, or an operator. You know, an operator, which all matrices are linear operators, and you can do coordinate transformations and things of that sort, right? There is no difference, except, and by the way, you probably have textbooks that would write this, like this, except that in this case, what is the B?
We were given like a value for B and we solved for X.
Okay, so if B is zero, then you have a homogeneous system, right? This is a little different because here we've got a prime. Okay. This is not a differential equation, whereas this is. And so you wouldn't, you know, you could put a zero there, and that would give you an equilibrium. But that's, I guess that'd be the same as saying AX equals zero here, but then where's your derivative?
Okay.
I don't know. It's this is a battle that if you're always thinking in terms of matrices versus linear algebra versus differential equations, the notations are a little different. And you just gotta, again, follow the style that is enforced at that point. When you get a little further along, then you can be a little bit more free-form with it, I think. Okay, equilibrium. So, suppose you have X prime equal... Now, sometimes you mix things. So you'll have the letter representing the vector, and then you'll have the matrix representing the coefficients so that you know what they are. So 1, 2, 0, 3. And then X here. Okay. And I ask you, okay, what are the... what is the equilibrium state or the equilibrium condition here?
X prime equals zero, right?
Yeah, X prime is equal to zero. So I'll make this equal to zero. Okay. Now, now those of you who had linear algebra can look at this instantly and see what's the only possible solution for X?
Zero.
Why is that? Well, if this 3 was a 0, would that be still true?
No.
X equal to Y?
If that's that, then X could be anything.
Well, not just anything, but it there are an infinite number of solutions. And they're constrained somewhat, but but there are an infinite number of solutions here for x. Whereas if I do this, that's no longer true. Why is that? Can anyone say there three or four or five people put up their hands when they said they had linear algebra? So what's going on with that matrix that tells me that the only solution is x equals zero?
I remember something about it being diagonal.
Okay, that's partly true. I mean, it's not diagonal in this form. Yeah. It can be transformed into a diagonal matrix.
Yeah.
What's the necessary condition for that to occur?
Upper triangular.
Yeah, well, it's already upper triangular. What else?
It has to have one on the leading end of the triangle.
What can you say about the matrix? I mean, besides the obvious descriptors that you're giving. Non-singular? Do you know? Those of you who've had linear algebra, you should be able to tell me what non-singular means. Okay. Yeah, that's a hard one. It means that you can find the inverse of the matrix. The inverse exists. And if it has an inverse, so call this A. So then AX equals zero. If A has an inverse, call it A inverse. Then A inverse times A times X is equal to A inverse times zero. What's A inverse times zero? Zero. Anything times zero is zero. What's A inverse times AX?
X.
Because A inverse times A is what? Not one. It's the identity matrix. If it's a 2x2, then the identity matrix is 1, 0, 0, 1. Okay. Just a little review there. So, I'm going to run out of time. I think you've seen enough. So the equilibrium, just one more thing. So what is the equilibrium in this case? X equals zero. Or because, I mean, we can think of this. So X, what is X? Well, it's X1, X2. Or X comma Y, if you're more comfortable with that. And so what's the equilibrium?
X1 equals zero, X2.
Yeah, so it's the origin. In this case, it's the origin, is the equilibrium. Now, it's in two dimensions, because you have two dependent variables, X and Y, in this case. So when we're talking about the phase portrait, which we'll get to, you know, you'll have, this will be X and this will be Y, or X1, X2, and then if this is equilibrium, then you'll have, you know, behavior like this, so spiral in or spiral out. Stuff like that. Okay? Okay. I'll stay around for a few minutes if you want to talk. Otherwise, you're free to go. And I'll see you next time. Have a good weekend. Be sure to turn in your homework if you've not already done so. And I handed out the sign-in sheet. Did that get around?
Yeah.
Everybody signed it?
Thank you.
Okay, good. Eduardo? Okay.
I have a question about how much matrices we need in neural physics. I haven't taken